and you are tuned into Thursday Night Talk, of course, right here on KHSU tonight. Eric Kirk is our host. As always, we welcome your contributions. Please give us a call at 826-4805 if you're out of the area at 800-640-5911 and to our text line at 492-KHSU.
Thank you, Michael. Good evening. This is Eric Kirk on Thursday Night Talk. My guest tonight, Professor Ryan Emanaker. Did I say that right?
You did.
Okay. Is a professor of political science at the College of the Redwoods and a PhD candidate at Brown University. His research focuses on judicial politics and constitutional law. He's written numerous pieces on the history and role of the Supreme Court, including an article on why the Supreme Court should uphold the Voting Rights Act, which appeared on SCOTUS blog and the premier news and research site on the Supreme Court. Tonight, we want to talk about, in honor of Black History Month, I was looking at anniversaries and 50-year anniversaries, and there are a number of things that happened 50 years ago, including the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King, who and actually it plays into a little bit of the history of the Fair Housing Act. He was working on those issues, as among others, when he died. But we're talking about the passage of the second Civil Rights Act or the 1968 Civil Rights Act, which contained a number of things, including Title IX, but also Title VIII, which is known as the Fair Housing Act. And Ryan, you want to talk a little bit about what that was, what Title VIII was and the Fair Housing Act?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, and I think it's great that we're talking about this near its 50-year anniversary. So Martin Luther King, a week after Martin Luther King passed, was killed. The Fair Housing Act was passed. And
what I understand about the history, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that it was actually going to be a much weaker version they were anticipating. But when he died, none of the politicians wanted to push that.
Yeah, well, and it's actually possible it wouldn't have passed. So it had been entered into Congress a couple years before and had sort of languished there. Mm-hmm. And so President Johnson actually was able to use Martin Luther King's death as a means to really make this happen. So,
And
this had become a big issue for Martin Luther King a couple years before he had died. He basically said, like, one of the number one things we need to address is fair housing because of so much of your life is determined by your zip code and where you're born. So issues of where you go to school, what hospitals you have access to, whether you parks and other things. And so if we aren't able to deal with housing discrimination and barring people from where they can live, we're not going to be able to address the racial inequities that exist in our society. So this was a huge thing that they really pushed for. So then Title VIII then was put in, and the basic idea then is that you could no longer, as a seller, renter, or landlord, discriminate against someone based on race, color, national origin, or religion.
Right, and there was a kind of a history of it because apparently between World War II and its passage, a lot of African Americans were moving out of the South and into the cities, and increasing pressures in terms of being ghettoized, being separated. Actually, segregation actually kind of increased in those areas more than they'd been in the South, and discrimination was a big deal because these, you know, people were there were people who were trying to keep them out, especially as industry was leaving the cities and other problems started to emerge because of that.
Yeah, so this is the sign of the big shift from where Civil Rights Act of like 1964 and the actions that were going before were largely targeting the South and worried about discrimination down there. By 1968, what we're starting to see is riots in the North, and the Johnson administration is trying to figure out how do we address this de facto segregation. So a lot of the policies they had in the past were de jure, so legal segregation that had existed in the past. Now all of a sudden they're trying to deal with this additional problem in the North, and how do you deal with this fact that when someone's selling their home, they're discriminating against other fellow citizens, not just that there is this legal discrimination. And so this became a challenge for them, and they're really trying to address that here with the Fair Housing Act.
As we mentioned, it was passed. Also, was passed with the help of I'm forgetting his name, but he was the head of the NAACP in Washington, and he pushed so hard he became known as the 101st Senator. He was they really wanted to push it through, and it's evolved since then. It was amended in 1988 with the ADA. To include the category of disability, and it applies, of course, to all of the suspect categories of discrimination.
Right, yeah, so they added sex in 74 and then disability status in 1988. So they'd added to it that way. And then California, of course, has its own version of the Fair Housing Act where it actually includes some additional categories, marital status, sexual orientation, gender identity, and so forth.
Right, yeah. California, you mentioned before, it's a bit stronger.
Yes.
And I just want to make kind of a note that the sort of my professional run-ins with some of these issues is I actually had somebody come into my office, an attorney, with some deeds of covenants from Benbow. Benbow is south of Garberville, and there's a covenant that was established in the 1920s when it was still, unfortunately, lawful, or at least hadn't been challenged in court, and the covenant says something along the lines, it's been a few years since I read it, but that if you are not white, if your skin is dark, and you're not a servant, you can only spend a certain amount of time in those buildings. You can't live there as a resident. You can be there as a servant, but that's it. And it's still in the books. Just because they pass the laws and the lawsuits happen, you still pull up a deed, and it's still part of it. It's not enforceable anymore. It's dead, but it's still there, and it's a legacy that's going to be with us.
Yeah, it's part of our ugly history. I have a somewhat similar story. I had a really good friend who's... mom, who's Mexican, and she had bought a home in Reading, so nearby us, and in that house there was the deed, there was a covenant that said this house could never be sold to a Mexican, and so she proudly displayed that on the mantle of her home, is the fact that, like, she as a Mexican was able to buy this house that the contract said, you know, the covenant said she'd never be able to do. And I thought that it was so shocking for me to be able to walk into that room and see that, and see that proudly displayed, and just try to think of how much our society's changed and how important governmental action like the Fair Housing Act is to changing society.
Right. And it does, you know, and all it does is provide a remedy, but then, you know, that is how change is kind of made in the United States. You pass the law, then people sue on it. It's not even, although there is an enforcement, I understand, you know, for the Fair EOP and the rest, but it's they usually have been resolved in court. There's even a discrimination case under the act against our current president's family at one time.
Yes.
In fact, I believe Roy Cohn was helped him in that one. That's another topic. But anyway, well, you have you've done a little bit of research for tonight. Is there any particular thing you want to focus on while we're?
Sure. I mean, I think broadly the first thing to say is that I think the Fair Housing Act is another one of these examples that shows the importance of government for making progress in people's lives and making change, and that these are one of these important things to happen. And we have these great examples like the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, and the Fair Housing Act is one of these really important things. I think it also points to the fact of how important the zip code you're born into is for your life. Mm-hmm. Three quarters of all students go to a local neighborhood school. And where you are determines then what school you go to, and often, you know, what hospitals you get to go to.
Right.
And so much of people's lives and their access to everything determined based on zip code. And so when people are excluded from that, we have huge problems. And so the Fair Housing Act then was this big push to make that change. Incredibly important for doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I would say it's an important, although incomplete, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done.
Right.
Most of the action now under the Fair Housing Act falls under disability status. So we're seeing about 40% of all actions there, both in California and nationwide,
right,
are tending to deal with disability status and changing that. But there was a study in 2010 that actually came out from Brown University that was looking at the fact that we still have really segregated zip codes, neighborhoods,
yes,
cities. And the analysis there was that actually that 90% of African Americans and Latinx people would have to move in order to have fully integrated communities.
Yes.
For that. And so acts like this still really important, and how they get enforced under the Obama administration.
Right.
We saw a huge uptick in the amount of funding for enforcement of this act.
Yeah.
We'll see where that goes. I know President Trump is going to be proposing his budget next week. We'll see what that looks like and where enforcement and those protections go in the future. But one of those things I think that's really important and sometimes we don't think about or pay enough attention to.
Yeah, I mean, and part of the problem is you can pass the laws that say you have the right to be in the house, but if you're part of the problem with different zip codes is there's usually different prices, right?
Yes.
You know, you got to have the money to be able to move there before you can even force your way into the neighborhood. You know, you got to be able to afford it. I mean, that's a big issue in San Francisco that they're dealing with. In fact, there was an actual example of gentrification being that really angered me, because you talk about zip codes. There are certain zip codes where there's a history of kids who are having difficulties in school, so they get better preference in that. Well, the gentrification is taking over, so that realtors are actually advertising, hey, rich person, come here, only $5,000 a month for rent, but if you're having kids, it's in one of those districts where you're going to benefit from, being able to have it, because it's so fluid right now and the neighborhoods are changing so quickly. And I don't think that's something the Fair Housing Act can
no, it hasn't. And I've actually seen some analysis that said that a modern day Fair Housing Act would include economics, and that we need some way to sort of think about that and address that. And I think some of the other things that are upcoming or interesting around the Fair Housing Act is how we deal with the growing share economy. So things like Airbnb and mm-hmm. Lyft and civil rights acts in general, since these provisions generally apply to public housing and public access. Now, the Fair Housing Act does actually apply to private residents and so forth, but there are exemptions for people that don't, that are within their own home or other ways. When you start having things like Airbnb, which are essentially then gathering together a number of independent contractors, there's actually some unresolved issues with how the Fair Housing Act might apply in issues like Airbnb and independent contractors and how we deal with that.
Yeah, not to mention labor unions and things
like that. Yes, absolutely. But, disability access, lots of those things are issues that regulation has not caught up with yet.
Right. No. It's hard to know how would you evaluate its successes or failures at this point. I mean, obviously things change, and so laws have to change and be adapted. But other than adding categories, do you know if the law has changed in any way to make it more effective in terms of all of the social and economic changes?
Yeah. So I think there's a couple ways we could look to try to evaluate it. One would be, do we have less racially segregated neighborhoods than in the past? And I think there are some examples of that being the case. Do we have better access for those with disabilities or not? I think so that becomes part of the measure. Another way to measure it is look at the number of complaints that are filed and how many are successful. Mm-hmm. And so we can look at that over time and whether those are increasing or decreasing and whether people are getting vindicated through the law. We see filed under the federal government, there's not that many actions. But one of the interesting things about the law is it allows nonprofit groups to help file many of these actions. So if we were to look back just a couple of years ago, there's only about 1,500 actions that HUD, so the Housing and Urban Development, filed itself. But there's 19,000 filed by nonprofit groups. Mm. And so we can look and start seeing what those are. And even for us in Humboldt County, if we're looking in a recent report from the state, there's about 40 actions in Humboldt County that were reported and resolved. And so we know that we have some people in our community that are able to live in homes that people were actively trying to prevent them from getting into, that they're now able to live in.
Yeah. It's been said that the first stage of gentrification are actually the white bohemian, low income people. And I did come across an article as I was reading for it tonight that an issue that when you guarantee low income housing in certain districts, it brings in that element and removes the fear that other people have of living in those neighborhoods. And then, eventually the Google employees move in, for instance. And I'll tell you, I lived in the Mission District right in the early 90s, and right near Mission Dolores Park, and I don't recognize the neighborhood anymore. Yeah. It was there was a mix, a lot of people there. I was going to law school, and on my side of I would say Valencia Street, there were probably more white people. It was more part of the Castro, the edge of the Castro, but you got to Mission Street and it was Latino, solid pretty much. And now you don't really see many Latino people until you get to the south end of Mission Street, and that it just seems like it's shrinking. It's all young white people wandering around there. And so, you can't discriminate against white people, right? But, you know, I think that's sort of the new thing it has to address is how do we address gentrification? In San Francisco, the Bay Guardian, before it got destroyed by the gentrification, said that San Francisco looks to be possibly the world's first economically cleansed city. And it's and I think it's less diverse than it was.
And those are not easy issues to address, right? So different cities come up with different policies to address that. But sometimes looking at the types of zoning laws they have sometimes makes things worse. So you can look at those policies and try to see what those are. Issues of whether you have rent control or not and what types of access. But I think you're right. San Francisco's going to run into a real problem where the people that are doing a lot of the labor that happens in that city that are not the high-wage labor jobs, those people need places to live too.
Right. They're driving from places like Sacramento right now. They can't afford that.
And, you know, at some point, a city stops functioning when you can't have people coming in to do those jobs. And so how do you figure that out? And so those are real problems that have to be addressed too. How do we deal with the economics, not just the other types of protected class that are there?
Yeah. It's an issue. It stopped being kind of an industrial city. I mean, we have to, you know, I look at San Francisco because I'm familiar with that. I remember when when because of mechanization and the rest, that the shipyards closed down and it stopped being a port city. Everything now goes to the East Bay. You still see the cranes there, the ones that that inspired George Lucas with the walkers that are along the canal between Island of Alameda and the rest. And so there's still a lot there, but nothing in San Francisco anymore. You know, it was the maritime where the longshoremen and the famous general strike, and San Francisco was up until maybe the early 80s a kind of a working class city, and it changed real quickly, and then the Google thing just absolutely changed it. And one of the issues in San Francisco is you have rent control, but they were never able to pass vacancy rent control. So you've got these incredible differences in the same house. You can have a flat where somebody is still rent controlled because they've been living there since the 1980s or earlier, but the person upstairs is paying five times as much because, you know, there's no limits between residencies. I don't know if it would have made a better difference, and I don't know how well rent control has worked in other areas. I know it's mixed.
These types of issues, the Fair Housing Act has not, the economic issues, it's not dealt with particularly well. Yeah. The types of things it's done well on, and we see it sort of creeping up again as we get some of these examples through social media and other things, where we've seen folks who are posting on Airbnb or some sites like this, and someone tries to reserve a room, and they get denied explicitly because they're African American or Asian American, and we've seen those types of things. Now, Airbnb, to its credit, doesn't allow that and will kick those people off.
Right.
But enforcing that becomes an issue. And you've had people, there was a hashtag going around for a while that was like Airbnb while black and the experiences that people would have. And so you can still see a real need for things like the Fair Housing Act, where that overt discrimination for even people that can economically afford to get into a community still being barred.
Yeah. Well, and of course, there's that famous Stevie Wonder song, You Can't Change Your Face. It talks about all the excuses that the sellers will make or the landlords will make to avoid it, you know, appearing that they're being racist and they're in discrimination, and they find some other reason, and it's probably really hard to track down. Even if you know it's happening, how do you prove it?
Right. No, yeah. And so this is another spot where we can try to evaluate the law, or we can see ways it's working. So one thing that we've seen some people do on Airbnb, one person in particular from North Carolina, he had booked a place, gets banned, or they originally allow him to book it. Then the person who is posting the space for rent decides they're not going to rent to him. The person makes a fake account with a different picture, uses a white picture now, and that person rents to that person. But we've got actually, this is part of the way that the enforcement happens. So when I talked about nonprofit groups doing the Fair Housing Act and enforcement, one of the things they do is they will send in fake renters and fake buyers. And they will have, you know, a couple who is Asian, a couple who is African American, a couple who's Native American, go in and see if they get denied, and then have someone come in with the exact same economic status or other, you know, types of information on the rental, application, and then they end up getting denied. And so we actually have some means of testing this where we can send in folks and do that. And that's part of what the Fair Housing Act does when it's being enforced. And part of what the government's doing is actually sending folks in to see if there is this type of discrimination.
So this isn't just a private effort. This is actual government. If they suspect something's happening, they'll send in.
Yeah, so not a much smaller percentage of the enforcement's happening from the federal government. Generally, the federal government is giving money to nonprofit groups that does this type of stuff.
Interesting.
But this isn't just private individuals having to sue on their own. There actually is organizations that help people with this.
Cool. Listen, you're listening to KHSU. This is Thursday Night Talk. My name is Eric Kirk. Ryan Emenacre is with me. We are discussing the Fair Housing Act tonight. The phone number, if you want to join the conversation, 826-4805 or 1-800-640-5911. That's 826-4805 or 800-640-5911. And if anybody has any personal stories of housing discrimination, that would actually be an interesting to hear. I've never experienced it. I think I've always been in the categories that I probably wouldn't, but I imagine it's been an issue. I know it's an issue sometimes for students. I don't know. They're not a suspect class, but when I was in Santa Cruz, there were definitely houses and neighborhoods that didn't want students in them. I remember one landlord saying, even when they're quiet, they're loud, you know, kind of a thing. But I don't know, like I said, if anybody has experienced that. We do have at HSU, I believe it's 3/4, something like that, people of color. And I wonder if they've had experiences locally. And, so if anybody wants to call in, 826-4805 or 800-640-5911 to talk about those stories, so it could be really helpful. We could talk about, you know, what types of changes need to be made at the federal level if we ever get a, you know, government again that's willing to even look at this stuff.
Right, and that becomes one of the big issues, right? So under the Obama administration, we see the amount of funding for the Fair Housing Act and for enforcement of it goes way up. That's one of the biggest jumps we've seen. Mm-hmm. You know, the worry is always that could always go back down and we'd see less enforcement of it.
Yeah.
We also saw under the Obama administration that one of the regulatory changes that HUD instituted to enforce the Fair Housing Act was that they were going to start caring about sexual orientation and mm-hmm. gender identity. That potentially, I haven't followed it closely, but there was discussion under the Trump administration that they were going to remove that and stop enforcing that as a regulatory element. And so we can see these types of changes where they can go from one administration to another.
Yeah, well, as we know, Trump was sued under the Fair Housing Act. He'd probably be happy to just ditch the whole thing, I'm sure. You know, and he's appointed people to agencies where those people have previously stated that those agencies shouldn't even exist. So I wouldn't expect a lot of initiative. There may be some institutional, inertia. The deep state, as he would call it, right? So, but we'll see. We're pretty scared about that he's going to clean out these agencies. But, I mean, that sounds innovative if they're, catching Airbnb on that or even putting out money to do that. That's, that's an innovation that could make a difference.
No, absolutely. And I think, the nice thing about the law is, yes, it has the element of government enforcement, but it also allows private actions. So mm-hmm. there is some element where an individual that feels wronged can get an attorney and can sue, and that's also helpful with this. Even when an administration is less eager to enforce it, there is still a means through which to get some relief. Hopefully.
Right. Yep. All right. We've got our first caller, Sandy. You're on the air.
Thank you. Yes, I'm a renter here in Arcata, and I've rented this house for almost 20 years. I live in the larger part of the house. Downstairs is a small area that usually is rented to a student.
Mm-hmm.
And the turnover is every 2 to 3 years. My landlady was looking, started even 10 years ago, to try and rent to minority students. It basically, the way the house is set up, it almost always has to be a woman. But the thing is, as they come through to apply, they don't have the paperwork or any indication of their financial ability to pay. It's a not knowing, a position of ignorance that they come to try and get a good rental. And I'm wondering if the university itself couldn't give information out to new students as to the paperwork, their financial statements, all the things that it's the standard thing for all the big apartment buildings.
Sure.
And evidently, they just show up with nothing.
It would be nice if it was addressed in the high school, actually, before they even come to college. You know, that the high school used to, before everything was teaching to the test, teach you life skills, how to maintain a checkbook, all these kind of things. And for those going to college, you would think that that would be something that they would learn in their senior year, you know, to be able to do it. I think the university should have that as part of its orientation, you know, but it'd be nice if they could be told that ahead of time and have it ready when they come, even have counselors and teachers helping them put together, you know, that kind of a thing. And I certainly don't blame the students for that, but that is definitely an issue. You know, if you don't know what you're supposed to do and how to prep the stuff, and nobody's teaching you, and they show up and they ask for it.
Exactly, and yeah. It's very difficult for these kids. They often knock on my door just before she's not here, and they want to be shown the apartment. And I'll ask one or two little questions, and I just know they're not going to get it. But lovely people that I would love to have as a downstairs person. But no financial paperwork, no showing that they have a grant or, you know, they have no way of showing that they can pay for the apartment.
Have you thought about contacting the university to talk to them about it, or your landlord calling them to say, look, I get all of these, all of your students coming here, and they're not prepared. They don't have what I need to know, you know, and maybe if enough landlords talked about it, the university would do that. Maybe the university system would talk to the high schools. I know it's a problem. I mean, I learned it, but that was back in the day when, you know, it wasn't all about teaching to the test, you know, when you had shop classes and home economics and things. And I think anybody who's college bound should be, that's a very important thing for them to learn.
Yeah, well, we may get this big new building over there, and there's going to be a lot of people needing their paperwork. So thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
And Sandy, I really thank you for calling in with that issue. And I think it is a real problem. I mean, I notice it even as a professor at College of the Redwoods. We will sometimes recruit students and bring students up. And students are coming from different parts of the states and aren't necessarily aware of how tight our rental market can be. So when you show up in August around Arcata, oh my goodness, like, it can be really tough. A lot of people are coming from areas where there's a much, the housing is not as restrictive, and there's a lot, and so they come up expecting, hey, I can just rent a place, it's not going to be tough,
and they end up living in their cars.
Yeah, and I do think that's an obligation that our institutions, both College of the Redwoods, Humboldt State, should be, when we're recruiting students and trying to pass that information on, of like, hey, we're a rural area, we have a very different rental market than you may be familiar with, here's some information. And I think the more people like Sandy, you bringing that up now and allowing our audience to hear about that, I think the more that we can talk to people in our community and start putting that out there, letting our institutions know that, hey, we've got to start telling people this so that they can understand both what they need to know intellectually and to be prepared to rent, and also just how our rental market is different than perhaps where you're coming from.
Yeah. Now, it used to be that your first year of college, you were guaranteed housing. I don't know if that's so much in effect anymore, but, you know, you're guaranteed a dorm spot. I don't know. Do you know if that's true with HSU? Or
I'm not sure where HSU is at. I know they've built some new housing recently. I know they have some, they're looking at what they might need to do in the future, and I'm not sure where they're at.
Yeah.
I know that some of the bigger rental properties have problems with this too. I know it only in a roundabout way. I live in a place where there's the Kramer, a number of the Kramer apartment buildings kind of surrounding me, and due to tree problems, I deal with them.
Mm-hmm.
And just in talking across the board, this has sort of come up. You know, you chat with people as you get to know them. And I had asked something about the rent in a nearby one, and they said, well, they never had problems renting there, but they did have problems with, they didn't call it their paperwork, that's what I've been calling it.
Sure.
But essentially that problem. So even the big rental companies, I think, might join in some way to make sure the people that showed up in front of them had the proper, I can afford this papers.
All right, Sandy, thank you very much for your phone call. That was really helpful.
Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
All right. Again, you're listening to KHSU. This is Thursday Night Talk. Phone number, my name is Eric Kirk. My guest is Ryan Emanaker, a professor at College of the Redwoods, and we are and PhD candidate, and we are talking Fair Housing Act, and we've sort of gotten into housing issues, which is what it's trying to address. Phone number, if you want to join the conversation, 826-4805, or if you're out of the area, 1-800-640-5911. That's 826-4805, or 800-640-5911. If you didn't get those numbers down, you can always check us out online, khsu.org. It has the phone numbers. The I mean, you know, again, you know, when you pass a law, it can't address everything, and that's obviously going to be a big issue. But it sounds like there could be de facto unintentional discrimination there if people are coming from communities where there aren't resources, where they're not getting prepared for this because the high schools are overwhelmed with other issues, dealing with other issues that they don't adequately prepare. We're not even just talking about at this point the college skills. Hopefully they've gotten some preparation there, but even just on what to do. And so does that mean that the, you know, anybody who is coming from maybe a wealthy area, community, HSU has an advantage there. And so even though there's not a case of landlords intentionally discriminating, just by virtue of that, that the ones who quote unquote have it together and have the paperwork, I mean, how do you address that within law, you know?
Yeah, right. I mean, I think as a community, maybe there's some things we could do. I think, you know, one, Sandy talking about that and bringing that up, I think trying to bring those types of stories to the administration at Humboldt State and the administration at College of Redwoods and say, hey, here's some of the things that we see students facing, and how do we address this as a community, and what do we come together and do? Talking about that with our local governments at Humboldt County and our other cities around. I think those are important aspects of it, right? That, yes, there's the intentional discrimination that happens, and that definitely needs to be addressed. But then how do we address these other problems that are part of it? How do we have community-based solutions to these things that maybe legislation is not as good at handling?
No, maybe there need to be programs and some grant money to be able so that the university can put out some information, maybe in its orientation packets that should be sent to students months in advance, you would hope, you know. I mean, it's just, it would be nice if they don't come and because, you know, it's hard for them to perform if they have to live in a car for the first 2 or 3 months until they do find a place, and they're in a community they don't even know, you know, anybody, unless their friends came before them, and the rest. I mean, that's got to be a really stressful, you know, hard situation, and not a very welcoming climate for, you know, for kids to come from, you know, communities elsewhere into our situation, where, you know, we've have our unique problems, houses that are being used for things other than residential uses. I mean,
no, yeah. Absolutely. And I think one of the things too is one of the big pushes throughout the state now is student success rates and how many pass and all these other things. And I think the more that we start talking about housing issues as part of student success, right, that how much harder it is to pass a class when you're living in your car, don't have stable housing. And the more I think we talk about it that way, the more we might be able to leverage some of those funds, right? So there's lots of money and initiatives going towards increasing student success. If we talk about housing as part of student success, I think it becomes another thing that we start adding to that puzzle and becomes important.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, it would be good. And it would be good because if they, you know, we graduate and maybe people will stay here, you know, if we actually find some employment, you know, it adds to anyway, that's, I mean, you know, there's, the problem with the whole approach of the I won't say problem, the limitations of the whole approach of Civil Rights Act and that is it's reactive. It provides a remedy when there's a problem that can be addressed at law with an individual who has wronged you. But when you're looking at you know, overall systemic issues, you need programs that can address it. You need affirmative, not even using the term affirmative action in terms of quotas, but affirmative action in terms of prepare the community for it and to allow for the opportunities to flourish. And how do we do that? And without, you know, people thinking we're doing social engineering and wanting to fight it on that basis, it's a struggle to get anything like that or spend any money on it.
Well, it's funny, Eric, you used affirmative action actually in the way it was originally used and intended, right? So when it first came up, the idea was that, well, we have these problems in our country and our society, and we can't just sit back and take passive action. We actually have to take affirmative action and go out and make changes and happen, right? And so part of all of these civil rights laws that came out were part of trying to see how to do that, and then as well as other things. But trying to have a Civil Rights Act, trying to have a Voting Rights Act, trying to have the Fair Housing Act, all of these things were part of this idea of affirmative action, not just waiting and hoping that things get better, but actually doing things towards that.
Well, and part of another issue is that in the 60s, we also had the Great Society, which kind of followed with the New Deal. We had some social experimentation, which is just looked down upon, I think, since the 1980s and sort of the conservative backlash to it, because certain programs failed means all programs must fail. And we don't really have a systemic way to look and say, well, you know what? That one's working pretty well, and that one isn't, you know? So maybe we have a little bit of flexibility to say, okay, under some conditions, let's take the successes and try to build on that. But it's just sort of like all or nothing. We either have this stuff in civil engineering bad, and, but you look at something like the preschool program that actually works.
Head Start,
you know, and maybe model after that. Okay, maybe we can come up with something, you know, learn from the successes, and maybe some of the Section 8 housing models or something, maybe they didn't work and we need to look at something else, and I don't know what or how it needs to be done, but part of the problem is you get a system in and then it's locked into that, and you got bureaucrats that run it that way, and there isn't a whole lot of discussion about innovation and the whole belief, well, government can't innovate anyway, you know, that's just its nature. And it's like, no, it can innovate, and it does. In Europe, other countries, it's innovating all the time. It seems to be here where we seem to have this idea that, you know, you got to have a profit motive to make it to innovate, and sometimes a profit motive doesn't make you innovate, you know, and sometimes it stagnates you too. It's sort of a inclusive thing. The Fair Housing Act gives you a right to sue, but that's not always what's going to solve the problem, and that's its limitations.
No, I think that's true, right? But the other element of the Fair Housing Act that I think is really helpful is the fact that the other enforcement mechanisms to find out when there is discrimination going on. And the other part I think that's been incredibly successful is it prohibits people from advertising their places in a discriminatory way.
Yes.
So you can't list things. And I think that's a really important message that gets sent out to our community, that if you are a member of this society and you start seeing ads that are saying people like you can't live here, I think that communicates a certain message. And I think taking that message out of the public discourse, I think, is a really important idea of creating equal citizenship and the idea that people have equality and belong and get to participate and are on equal footing with their fellow citizens. Yeah. And so I think that's another part of the act that's really, really important is banning that type of advertising where you're saying we don't want people like you.
And it's been pretty effective at that. It's driven it underground a little bit. My wife is Jewish and she was raised in a portion of Connecticut where there was a place that was known as Kike Hill, because that's where the realtors would try to direct the people moving out of New York City who were Jewish or looked like they might be Jewish, and they sort of got congregated in this area. Now, they picked up on it and they started to not want to be treated that way, and things changed. But it was, but nobody was discriminating. It's just where the realtor showed you, oh, you'd be very comfortable in this neighborhood, you know, and it's and very subtle. But you know, but if it's not. And it's all in how you're marketing it too, where you market and the rest. But anyway, it's
I mean, and some of the other things too, I think part of the act, right? So for a long time, we ended up with very segregated neighborhoods, and oftentimes people try to think of that as purely de facto segregation that it just happened. But a lot of these things were engineered, right?
True.
So, for example, banks would only give people loans to certain
right.
neighborhoods based on certain
yeah.
risks. So part of what the Fair Housing Act did is prevented that. And we did see after the act passed, actually, that neighborhoods became more integrated, and we saw a lot of that. And as the when the law was enforced at higher rates, we actually saw more integration happening. We've seen some backsliding, too, that's happened.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think there are some real successes, and I think, you know, you're talking, Eric, about how we're trying to look for some of the successes and that we often don't see them. I think that's one of the things that's nice talking about the Fair Housing Act. Has it solved every problem? No, but I think...
Great.
It's one of these things that's actually done a lot, and we should celebrate that. And I think we have other examples. I think the Voting Rights Act was unbelievably successful, and we have some data on that.
Yeah.
You know, so we have other programs that we can look to and say, wow, this, we have been able to improve our society and do that. That doesn't mean that we have to stop working or that we don't tinker or that we don't come up with new ideas. But I think when we have successes, we need to celebrate them. And when we don't, what we risk is people saying, nothing ever works.
You had the, it had its impact on popular culture. In 1968, this law passed. And a few years later, you had a spinoff from a series called All in the Family, referred to as the Jeffersons. They tied the whole song, moving on up to the East Side, and, about a black family that moves into a mostly white, affluent, hotel, criticized because it focused on the affluence. So he moved out of a working class neighborhood and didn't really address it, but it indicated that there was some kind of success, because popular culture usually follows a reality. It's based on something that resonated. The show was popular because there were experiences like that happening. Are there, is there much of the same type of, not just social mobility up, though, but sideways? We don't know. I mean, it's hard to track. But at any rate, you look at the Airbnb situation too, and that's just as what is the car one? Uber
and
the rest. And of course, you've got all the labor issues, the regulatory issues, taxi companies and hotels saying, why do I have to abide by all these regulations? And they don't. We have to address that. And as you've suggested, it makes it possibly a little bit easier to discriminate, which means it's got to be looked at with problems particularly aimed at that, and that's where we have to innovate.
Yeah, right. So one of the big issues is that, in most places, cab companies and so forth, they're going to have to have some sort of access for people with disabilities. Airbnb, Lyft drivers don't. And actually, we're seeing a lot of folks in the disability rights community coming forward and saying, I actually have less access today to be able to get, right,
because there are fewer taxi cabs.
Fewer taxis.
Yeah.
And so now the access to do that. There is actually a company, I wish I could remember their name, similar to Lyft or Airbnb, but they actually bill themselves as a company that makes themselves accessible.
That specializes, yeah.
And so hopefully we see more of that. We see Uber and Lyft respond to that, and we see that increasing. Or we see some regulation trying to push that way. I think one of the reasons that Airbnb has been good on this is that they're worried about the regulations that might come down the what might happen. And so they've been very explicit. We're not going to allow people on our site that aren't going to abide by these types of policies. I don't know that they necessarily are as keen to do that without the fact that they're worried about the regulations that could happen if they didn't.
Right. I have a question about that, but let's first take Freddie in McKinleyville. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Going pretty well.
Good.
How about you?
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Pretty good. Yeah, pretty good. So my question is, with the rising cost of rent and stagnated wages, what can the public do in regards to affordable housing?
Well, that's the big question, especially in the state of California. That is the big question, because that is where the discrimination happens, and you can't, where the de facto and even some deliberate discrimination can happen. I mean, it's certainly an issue. Does Fair Housing Act address it in any way?
The Fair Housing Act doesn't directly, but this is something that has to be looked at. And I think it's something that, like, we here in Humboldt County are going to have to start figuring out. Like, one way to make housing more affordable is to build up a little bit more, right? And so,
yeah.
And we in rural areas tend to be a little bit wary of doing those things. But if you continually to build out rather than build up, you keep prices up and you also start encroaching on other lands. And so one of the conversations I think we need to start having in our county, and here we are sitting in Arcata having, you know, where we're in the studio, it's one of the things I think Arcata needs to start talking about is, how do we start building things that go up and start having housing that way? That's one way to keep costs down
for developers. Infill too. In the existing areas. And we've had discussions about smart growth that includes provisions for lower income housing to any particular thing. They usually complain about that. I forget what it's called, inclusive housing or something, but that, you know, they've got to have a certain amount of low income, but how do you define it? How do you regulate the prices once it's done? It's not an easy question, but that is probably the biggest segregating factor these days.
Yeah, and there is a couple of groups. I know, like, Humboldt Bay Housing Authority has come up with some interesting models where someone can get, like, a really affordable mortgage, but the Humboldt Bay Housing Authority will then keep part of the profits if you ever sell the place later. And so it's a way to help people get into a house, but also then a way to keep that money coming in so we can continue to make housing that's affordable for folks.
Sure.
So there are a couple of models that are out there. This is not something that happens quickly. I mean, I would encourage people, get involved with different committees, either at the city or county level. There are committees that work on these issues and start talking about how important this is. I think call some of those elected officials and say, hey, this is stuff we care about, and keep putting that to the forefront and saying, like, we really care about this stuff. The more that local officials hear that this stuff matters, I think that helps change or helps encourage them to keep pushing for those types of things.
Yeah, I mean, and of course, it's hard. You can't really address anything in isolation. One of the reasons that housing is unaffordable to a lot of people is they can't get decent income because we are having a hard time finding livelihoods that are similar to what we had in the 60s and 70s, and particularly for those who aren't college educated, but even for many who are. And so the question, you know, is well, okay, you got to work on sort of an economic development. There are people who argue that carefully planned gentrification is not necessarily a bad thing. You bring in certain neighborhoods that are kind of like a tax base and a service, you know, purchasing base, and that maybe trying to attract some high tech people, you know, into the community would be a good thing. But you got to have the infrastructure for it. You got to have the internet, you know, that doesn't go down every time somebody, you know, runs over a cable in Willits with a tractor, right?
So, sure. Yeah, Freddie might appreciate this story. I know, like, I was having a conversation with my dad some number of years back, and he mentioned to me that when he bought his first house, he was a short order cook at IHOP. Mm-hmm. And I just almost fell out of my chair. I was like, the vision that someone could buy a house today as a short order cook, that we don't exist in that world.
No, we don't. 1968, a fry cook in many communities could buy a house.
Yeah.
You could do it. I mean, it was, if you worked in a trade union, you could afford it. You made good money back then. It's just, and the wage, the American working wage has declined almost every year since 1971, with maybe two or three years exception where there was an actual real wage. I mean, that's, you know, something we can't deal with. And you got the whole national thing, you know, in 1974, 4 out of 10 American jobs were manufacturing. Now it's 1 in 10. Maytag hasn't added a domestic job since 1991. I mean, you know, we've got all these stories. And so, you know, there's no law that we can pass or tweak that's going to fix all these problems. It's got to be a multiple, many part, moving part solutions.
So Freddie, I regretfully, what we're telling you is that it's difficult. But I would encourage you, though. I think do check out county, local government, see which ways, and put it out there that that's an issue and that matters. I think Sandy's call earlier was really important. I think the more that we talk about this, discuss this, and let folks who care about these issues and who are trying to think through these know that this matters to us, I think the better off we are. That's a first step, at least.
What can we do about stagnated wages in general? I mean, is that a topic that has to be kind of discussed on a national level, like
a
pushback, or, you know, is it more laws passed to protect unions to allow that sort of collective bargaining to push back against, you know, employers?
I mean, so I'm often a person that I would say yes, yes, and yes. So often I think there's many things that have to happen there. I think the things you listed are important. I think on some level, right, I think a minimum wage increase in California is something we could look to and matters. I think a minimum wage increase federally matters. Again, many people aren't aware that, like, when minimum wage was first created, the idea was that actually that was a living wage. The idea was it was pegged at a rate that that was enough where one wage earner working full time could provide for a family of four.
Yeah.
Now, that's laughable today to think that making minimum wage working 40 hours a week at that rate would allow you to provide for a family of four. That's just no longer what we're at.
And if you're in a recessionary phase of the economy, it's actually stimulative. People always think, well, you make labor more expensive, people are going to lay people off. But minimum wage workers are usually the people who have to be there. And you give any increase to them, they're consumers. They can't save that money. They're going to spend it. So it is stimulative. And so there's been conflicting data, but sometimes increasing minimum wage actually stimulates an economy. It could also cause inflation, which is maybe what, you know, we could have used over the past 8 years, but you know, a little bit of it. But it's it's complicated. So you got to have a multi-level policy that addresses that. Of course, that's the very bottom level. Maybe if that produced more work, there would be more sort of a leapfrog thing. You know, are the unions in trouble because of loss of jobs? Are we losing jobs because the unions are in trouble? I mean, it's there were a lot of direct attacks on the unions in the 1980s, starting with Patco and the rest. But if there's no industry to unionize, there's no unions. I mean,
you know, and I think it's no coincidence that we went from housing to employment pretty quickly. So
yes.
Actually in California, the law in California, it's actually the Fair Employment and Housing Act. So the Fair Housing Act in California actually is tied with fair employment, and they have the same category of protected classes in the laws,
right,
and the same things. And I think it makes sense the two go hand in hand, are trying to be protected together, that housing and employment actually do matter in what wages are and what income is.
Right. You know, our measure of economic health is always housing starts. They always, you know, refer to that. That's like, if we have lots of housing starts, the economy's being healthy, or at least it's expanding, and the rest. And I guess there's like a lot of multiple indications there, but I think it's correlation more than causation. I don't think if you go out and say, okay, we're going to start a bunch of houses, that's going to necessarily mean the economy is okay. But we haven't had a whole lot of housing construction in Humboldt County in a while. So,
yeah, and one of the issues with building new housing is that, you know, it takes a while, right? So we went through the period of recession. Nobody's building during that time. And now the economy is slowly starting to come up, but people are, you know, by this point, they're now starting to plan and think about doing housing, but it takes years before that goes online, right? And so there's a lag time between how the economy's functioning at any given moment and what people are able to then start building at that moment, because they have to go through the planning process and everything. And so I think we're at one of those moments where, you know, the economy has started to improve slowly over the last several years. We're just now starting to see new housing stuff start to go online based on those improvements that happened over the last 4 or 5, 6 years.
Right. I have to ask, in evaluating the success, are there more or fewer lawsuits than there were? Have you seen any indication? I imagine every time you expand the categories, there's at least a flurry of them. But
so there's the big thing is the big shift. So it used to be a lot more race-based discrimination that was happening under the Fair Housing Act. Those have gone down, and so it seems like the number, at least, of reports of people saying that they're facing this has gone way down. The number of reports, though, for disability status and that being an issue has gone up. I think this makes sense, right? So disability doesn't get added as a status until 1988.
Right.
So there's a longer period, a shorter period of time for it to
And let me ask you before, is it primarily that the disabled are being discriminated against, or because the housing is inadequate to them?
So one of the things is that in the law is about making reasonable accommodations.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone is renting a place and they're there and they want to make an accommodation that does not add to the expense or destroy the home or do anything like that, the law says that you have to approve reasonable accommodations. And so most of the category then are people complaining that their landlord or the person selling a place is not willing to make a reasonable accommodation for them.
Right. And, of course, you know, a lot of landlords aren't rich. They don't have a lot of money. That's their sole right. source of income.
But yes, but by definition, a reasonable accommodation means it can't incur an expense for them. Sure. So it's if the person living there themselves is incurring the cost and it doesn't do any damage to the home, someone's still preventing them from doing that.
Right. Yeah. Something there. And sometimes it's just, you know, it's bars in the bathrooms to access and stuff like that. That's usually not that expensive. But it probably most houses aren't required to put ramps or anything like that.
Sure.
It's
right.
Yeah. It just, you know, it depends on the circumstances. I'm assuming it's not as strict with housing as it is with businesses.
Yeah, so and businesses can fall under a different category too. Mm-hmm. So most businesses are going to fall under the 1964 Civil Rights Act in Title II, depending mm-hmm. on so restaurants and other things like that. So you sort of have some overlapping stuff where hotels are partially in Title II and partially in Title VIII. So you've got some different categories. And then there's a lot of exemptions for stuff that falls under the 1964 Act. There's fewer exemptions for the 1968 one, but there still are some of that too. So if you don't live in California, there are lots of exemptions for people that are not bound by the Act. So if you only have a couple of units that you're renting, if it's owner-occupied, then you don't have to follow any of this stuff either.
Right. Well, we're getting towards the top of the hour. I would actually like to invite you back sometime closer to the election to talk about the Voting Rights Act, which is actually even a little bit more your specialty, as we read.
Yeah.
And obviously, it's coming up in different forms, and we'll talk about whether there's much left of the Voting Rights Act after that Supreme Court decision. But do you have any thoughts you want to kind of wrap this up in?
Yeah, I mean, I think the two big things here is I think when we have governmental successes, we need to celebrate them. And I think there are some things to really celebrate the Fair Housing Act, and I think it's really mm-hmm. important. And so when we see that, I think we do have to remember that government can be a force for good. And I think here is one example. I think we do still have a long ways to go. But I think those are two things that can be mirrored together. And I think also always remembering the importance of like people's zip code and defining where their life is and trying to figure out ways that we make that less so is really important to think about.
Yeah. I mean, Title IX certainly has its successes. I think it was as of 2000. I don't know what the figures are now, but women's and girls' participation in sports in schools and the rest increased like 900% over that period of time. And I would actually consider the success of the women's soccer team to be an example of Title IX. The reason they can beat teams like Brazil, whereas the men's teams have a hard time even qualifying to even get to the World Cup. The women routinely win it or get to the finals and maybe lose to Japan or Germany or something like that. But, I think it's also because soccer is one of the opportunities women can have to make money, whereas men go to the top four sports. But Title IX is clearly successful, Title VIII to a certain degree. It'd be nice to actually kind of look over and see, but it sounds like that those were tweaks that may have even carried it beyond the 1964 in terms of its overall impact over these past few decades.
Absolutely. Title IX is one of these things that's amazingly successful, and I think, sports is one of them, and I think the other aspect of it is if we look at the number of women that are graduating from colleges and universities has gone up significantly, and that's really important.
Although one of the problems is men aren't going anymore, and that's actually starting to be a problem, but
so we got to think about that too and how we work with that, and I think the Fair Housing Act actually helped a lot with looking at improving education rates among all groups in society, and that's also important. And so we see some additional success there for education and people having access to better schools, and that's part of Fair Housing Act success as well.
We haven't had anything really sweeping legislation like that since ADA in 1988 was pretty close, but we haven't really had something like that on the level. I mean, well, medical, obviously, and we'll see where that ends up in a few years. But some type of sweeping legislation would be nice if we could come up with a plan that works for the United States that talks about, how are we going to, what is our economy going to look like, and have some policy. But just even talking about the economy as a matter of policy reeks of socialism to so many sectors of politics, socioeconomic politics. That's going to be difficult. But
yeah, and I think the Affordable Care Act is one of those things that had that potential. We've lost some aspects of it already, but I think but I think there was some elements of that were really amazing with the number of people that were getting health care that were not before. I think that was, and so that may be the one other one that we could maybe point to that was a major legislative hurdle beyond the Americans with Disabilities.
And it's never going to be gone. It's gonna always be there. Listen, Professor Ryan Emenacre, I will invite you back. Thank you very much for being here. It was a great conversation, and I would like to take you up on the Voting Rights Act sometime before November's election. Thank you, Michael, for engineering. Thank you for the callers. And we will talk to you next month, second Thursday next month.
You've been listening to Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Thanks to our host, Eric Kirk, and our guest, Ryan Emenacre. We love to get feedback on our programs. Please email thursdaynighttalk@khsu.org and like our Facebook page, Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Coming up next week on Thursday Night Talk,
join me, Lorna Bryant, for the next Thursday Night Talk, The Race Beat, in honor of Black History Month. Joining me will be vocalist Paula Jones and pianist Letty Dyer. Together, we'll discuss, play, and sing music from early spirituals to gospel to jazz, blues, and soul. Thursday Night Talk, The Race Beat on KHSU.
Thanks to KHSU producer Geraldine Goldberg, our theme music is composed and performed by Jeff Kreider. My name is Michael. I've been your studio engineer tonight. Stay tuned to KHSU. No Room for Squares is coming up next. It's 8 o'clock.
On the next episode of My Favorite Lecture,
this is Lonnie Grafman. Join us as we talk about